I think, well, it's great to have such a meeting like this with Bayesian statisticians from machine learning, Bayesian machine learners and Bayesian statisticians coming together. But so I just want to mention that there's a yearly conference where we also try and get together. I've noticed that at dinners last night there was kind of a split. The machine learners went together and the statisticians went together. But we need to spend more time at the beach together. So the conference is in La Palma, Canary Islands. The submission deadline is October the 14th. And you can just search for AI stats. And you'll find more information about that. So that's the plug. The next bit is I just want to show that there's lots of maths in my work. This is the Fadiva function, and it's appearing in here. So that's the complex scaled Earth, but you won't see that in the talk. If you want to read the maths and see lots of, there's lots of results here as well. Look at that, tables, images, all sorts. Brilliant. More results. Okay, so I'm not going to really show that because I've only got half an hour, and I actually want to really focus on the motivation for the work because I think that's probably the more interesting side. Okay, so start of the talk. So the talk's entitled Latent Force Models. I should mention my collaborators, Magnus Rattray, I co-PI on a lot of grants with him. Mauricio Alvarez is a PhD student who's been behind a lot of the work seen here, but also ex-postdocs Pei Gao, Antti Honkala, who is a visitor, David Luengo, who is a visitor, Guido Sanguinetti, who's in Edinburgh now but was a postdoc, Michaelis Titsias, a recent postdoc, Jennifer Withers, PhD student. They've all sort of contributed to this framework in some way. I'm not showing all of their work now, but there's a broader spectrum of work that involves all of them. So, what's the motivation? Well, there was a very, what I thought was depressing keynote talk. No, it was a good keynote talk by Urs Hultzel, I don't know how you pronounce that well, from Google in about NIPS 2005. And what he basically said was NIPS in 5 years' time, which is past now, I suppose, is going to be about massive data sets, millions data points. And it's going to be about the sort of things that Google does really, really well, which is to take fairly simple models, combine them with enormous amounts of data. The main problems are computational parallelizing it, let the data do the work, more data, less extrapolation. And why did I find that slightly depressing is because I don't really want, I mean, I think it's great that people do it, but personally, I don't want to spend a lot of time worrying about the computational side of my algorithms. I want to work on small data sets and spend a lot of time thinking about the model. And I think he's right. That's why it was depressing, that that's a really important paradigm. But there's an alternative paradigm, which I think is perhaps much more interesting from an academic side, because actually the better Google get at doing this, the less responsibility we have in academia for doing it, because companies are doing it, and they're doing it very well. But the alternative paradigm is different. Very scarce data. And scarce could still be large data sets, but scarce data can play to the complexity of the system you're interested in. So in particular, we can think about computational biology, where you're trying to understand all the complexities within, for example, a cell. What are all the processes going on in that cell to sustain it, to reproduce itself, to fight off infection? It's extraordinarily complex. And even though there's now gigabytes of data available, that data is very scarce compared to the complexity of the system. Human motion's another one. So I like human motion because it's an example of a high-dimensional data set that you have a very strong intuition about. That I can show you high-dimensional data that's human motion capture data. I can show you a playing image of that, and you can say, oh, that looks correct. And if you look at human motion data, what's interesting, I can move in sort of natural ways across here, and you think, yes, he's moving in quite a natural way, and we could model maybe me walking. But as soon as I sort of wave at you as well, then that's still natural, but it's different from the walk, so we need more data for the wave. We need to actually understand the structure of what I can do with my arms while walking and keep it natural. You can all identify that these are natural motions. If I were to do something very strange, you would identify it. But you need a large amount of data to actually model that. Or you need to include more assumptions about the data, so such as invariances. So this sort of brings me to what I would broadly characterize. I think I'm in the business of data modeling of data, but modeling in general is a sort of wider topic, and I think there was a time when the two weren't separated. So if you go back to Laplace, in the sort of period after Bayes. By the way, we're celebrating the death of Bayes. Shouldn't this be a frequentist workshop? We should be celebrating his passing so that Price could find his paper and publish it. Anyway, okay. But going back to that era, we're talking about the turn of the 19th century. People like Gauss and Laplace wouldn't have distinguished between the two areas I'm talking about here, which is data modeling and mechanistic modeling. So what I would characterize we have today, and this Gaussian bumps are supposed to be indicating where the activity is. The data modeling is the sort of traditional statistics machine learning side, and where you just let the data speak. Mechanistic modeling is where you actually, you're a physicist and you impose physical laws. So say climate modeling, you know the Navier-Stokes equations, and you impose those on your system. This is data-driven and this is knowledge-driven in general. Now, Darren had a great talk yesterday, which is between these two, and that's sort of what I want to emphasize as well. Here we have adaptive models, and here we'll typically have differential equations, or they might be difference equations, or any type of mechanistic assumptions. And this is in machine learning, a classic example would be digit recognition. And here we might think about climate and weather models. But I think if you go back to, say, work that Laplace and Gauss were doing when they were first actually implementing ideas of Bayesian inference in this area, and the equivalent of maximum likelihood, I don't think they ever seen a separation between these two. They wrote down physical laws, they observed the positions of the planets in the universe, and they tried to fit those physical models to data. And it's interesting that over the intervening years, there's become this sort of split where a lot of people in climate and weather modeling don't use data to fit their models, and a lot of people in this area aren't so much, well, we're using what I would say are weakly mechanistic assumptions. So, as Zubin said, you can't, if you just take data and you don't apply any assumptions, you just have data. And it's actually very, very quick. You don't have to spend any time working with the data. So what we actually do is we impose assumptions. And I would say they're weakly mechanistic. So there are assumptions like smoothness. Smoothness emerges from the physical world, from processes like diffusion. And in fact, you can see certain Gaussian process covariance functions as being the result of the diffusion process. The interesting thing is, we're taking quite a broad, flexible mechanistic assumption and combining in the data in such a way that actually, if our aim is that if the data doesn't quite match our assumption, it doesn't matter. Now, as Darren showed, with the deterministic Locke de Volterra process, you basically, once you've got another parameters, that's going to output the same thing every time. If you're trying to fit that to data, which isn't actually from a Locke de Volterra process, you're not going to get a good fit. And that's a problem on this mechanistic side, where you're making strong mechanistic assumptions about your system. So if those assumptions are wrong, you're going to get very bad performance. But if those assumptions are right, what I would claim is what we often think of extrapolation can become interpolation. So to give an example, if you're going to fly to the moon, and you've only observed satellites going around the Earth, and you don't know about Newton's laws, then you can't say how satellites are going to go around the moon. Of course, if you know about Newton's laws, and you're prepared to introduce that physical assumption, then you know how that becomes interpolation, because you just need the mass of the moon, and you can interpolate for how satellites are going to go around the moon. So by introducing more mechanistic assumptions into our data modeling, we can turn situations that were extrapolation into interpolation. Now, Darren was, I think, talking more about this case, and that is a really important case. Moving also from this direction towards this direction, I'd say there's two major things that are going on in this area. One is ABC, which is going to be talked about later, and Darren also mentioned. And I think the other thing that I'm not sure if it's going to be talked about, but is also really important, is emulation models. So taking physical mechanistic models and replacing a component with them with an emulator and doing inference on the resulting system, the emulator system rather than the simulator. I think those are two really important movements which are going from the mechanistic modeling side to the data modeling side, and we've already seen a little bit about that so far. What I want to talk about though is how we can maybe think to introduce more mechanistic assumptions inside our data models. So I think I've mentioned all those things, but let's give an example of where I think that this is happening. So Here's a simple model, a linear relationship between data, where I've got my data in a design matrix, so data points are in the rows, and some latent variables, which I've called f. So to get x, we've got a low-dimensional f, where q is lower than p, and we're going to multiply f by w and add some noise to recover our data matrix x. How do we deal with such a model? Well, if we don't know what f is, then we can integrate it out, and we've got a latent variable model, and we can optimize with respect to w. So for a Gaussian prior over this latent variables and specific choice of covariance functions for the noise, we get models like probabilistic PCA. Or you could also have independent component analysis for a different type of prior here, or you could have factor analysis if sigma is constrained to be diagonal. So a nice simple model, very, very widely used principal component analysis. I think it's particularly interesting the Hertelling paper where the term's introduced in 1936. His interpretation of principal component analysis is very much in line with this. Pearson talks about a different type of interpretation, which I don't really think is in line with the factor analysis interpretation, but I love that 36 paper. So very old model and very useful model. And you can take this and extend it. So let's say that we've got temporal data. Well, we can make our prior over those latent functions relate to time. So we could put Gauss Markov priors over each of these latent functions. So these are now functions through time now. And then we get Kármán filter or the Rauch-Tung-Strebel smoother. But more generally, we could actually consider, say, a full Gaussian process prior on those latent functions. So the thing about that is because of this linear relationship here, if we have a Gaussian process defined over time on this f, so each data point is now a time point, then the implication is we also have a Gaussian process across all x, a joint Gaussian process. And in machine learning, this is called the semi-parametric latent factor model. Yu-I Tae is here. He's mentioned in two talks now. Geostatistics, it's called the linear model of co-regionalization. But typically, this sort of Gaussian process model, and so UI and his colleagues were talking about more general inputs, not just time. You could have spatial as well, and of course, in this whole modeling framework, that could be true here. But let's focus on time. This Rauch-Tung-Strebel smoother has been preferred, and I'd say that's because of the linear complexity in N. But there's been a lot of advances in, I'm not sure if sparse is the right word, some people have said parsimonious approximations would be better, on the general Gaussian process framework, which make it a lot more practical in this type of scenario. So I'm sort of suggesting that we consider models like that more actively. Now, if we take a covariance function for our Gaussian process, which is, I presume most of you are familiar somewhat with Gaussian processes, but the idea here is basically is the covariance function is the key component of the Gaussian process. It describes how different time points in this case are correlated. So green is zero, so time point 25 and time point 1 are not correlated. Time point 1 and time point 2 have a very high correlation coefficient associated. If you choose alpha to 1, this is actually a correlation matrix, not just a covariance matrix. So I want to consider this type of covariance. I think that's interesting because it's sort of the opposite of what people are typically looking at, which is a Markov process. So you could write down the OU covariance, and you'd have a Markov process under this scenario. But let's kind of go to the right, to the extreme end, because this isn't Markov. There's actually infinite dependence across all time between the different time points for this covariance function. Now, back to the mechanistic model. So that's the sort of base model I want to start with that I think we would all, certainly in machine learning and statistics, I think we would recognize as a data-driven model. Now, these models are relying on the latent variables to provide the dynamic information. So you've got some sort of latent process over time and then some sort of observations coming out of that. So what I want to do is introduce a further dynamical system with a mechanistic interpretation. And the way I want you to think of is that these latent functions are forces. Thus the name, latent force models. It's supposed to be emphasizing the fact that there is a mechanistic interpretation. And what you're observing is the displacement of P springs to the forces. Now, if you write down the force balance equation for that, it looks just like this. And let's say if the forces, there's a reduced number of forces acting on the system through levers. So there's only Q forces, and then there's levers or pulleys operating on the system. So someone's sort of moving a few forces, and you're seeing larger systems moving. So the matrix which represents those levers and how they're acting we'll call S. And the diagonal matrix of spring constants we're calling D. So the original system would be recovered if we just set W equals S times D to the minus 1. So the idea there is, yes, there's a physical interpretation for this model we've been talking about. Perhaps not a very interesting one because there's no masses and there's no dynamics. Well, that should be the clue, because that means that this model will not pick up things like resonance. It won't understand inertia. So there's something missing. The point here is that there's a weak mechanistic assumption under our model. What's the clever bit about the data modeling scenario is there's an unobserved F. So you can control what's going on in this model by having flexible forms for F. And that's where we win over the sort of strongly mechanistic system. So again, Darren was showing the case where if you're missing with a, I can't remember if it was the prey or the predator, if you don't observe the prey or the predator, then you get the ability to infer what that's doing in order to describe the other object. And we've got a very flexible Gaussian process prior over F. So that's why this model works, even though there's a quite a dumb mechanistic model underneath it. But we can potentially make it better by adding extra assumptions. So now this is just a second order mechanical system, so we add masses, dampers to the springs. This means that we can now express things like resonance and inertia, which are actually, I think these are, so I'm looking at a tree over there and it's wobbling around, you know, it waves around like this, it's sort of oscillating. I expect things to oscillate. I have an intuition about oscillating, but it's not often very encoded in a lot of machine learning algorithms. Smoothness is, but I think oscillations are almost as natural a thing to include. So that's the reason for going for this one as a first example. So the basic idea now is something like this. So two analogies. Took a long time drawing these. I was a mechanical engineer for undergraduate, and I always thought I would be drawing things like this for my career. So this is a mass spring damper system, and the idea is basically there's one force coming in here, and these are operating on these mass spring dampers. You don't observe what this force is, but what you do observe is the displacement of these two masses. So that's the sort of mathematical analogy, but perhaps a better analogy for certainly for how you might model human motion capture would be, say, a marionette. So the marionette is quite a nice simple thing. You've actually got perhaps two forces that you can impose by just going like that in two different directions, and it's hooked up to various parts, but there are masses associated with these parts, so they respond in different ways. And a skilled puppeteer can make a marionette appear to move in a somewhat naturalistic type of way. So the model in this case would be that actually these are the unobserved, as someone watching the puppet, you don't observe the motion of the puppeteer because he's hidden, but you do observe the result, which is X. And the model, this model we're describing is trying to do the same sort of thing. Now the nice thing is that, so as Darren said, if I'm missing, I mean, and this is a very related system to the one Darren's talking about, but it's chosen in such a way that those path integrals are tractable. So the nice thing is that if this is a Gaussian process, well, you can actually, I mean, I didn't know all the details of how you work it out when first thinking about this idea several years ago, but I could tell that these must be Gaussian processes. Because, for example, the gradient of a Gaussian process is a Gaussian process. So if that were a Gaussian process, that's the gradient of the Gaussian process is a Gaussian process, and so is the gradient of that. So those are all additive Gaussian processes, so they must be a Gaussian process, and these are, on the other side, must be Gaussian processes as well. Or certainly it is the case that if you define F to be a Gaussian process, then X is also a Gaussian process. But it's rather a sexy Gaussian process, because it does some rather cool things. So this is what you get for the solution for the covariance function. This is what you get for the solution for x from that differential equation. So it's this convolution over the Gaussian process multiplied by a deterministic function. Now, a Gaussian process multiplied by a deterministic function is a Gaussian process. The integral of a Gaussian process is a Gaussian process, another deterministic function, and then just the sum. So x is a Gaussian process. But what's nice is we can now show the actual covariance structure in that system. And the really cool thing is that for different damping ratios, so this is three different output observations where we've got an underdamped, an overdamped, and a critically damped system, you get these different effects. So you get resonance here in the underdamped system, and you get, the overdamped is this one, so it's a little bit more diffuse, and the critically damped is actually trying to follow F as well as it can, and it's sort of similarly quite strongly correlated to F, but there's a slight time lag. So I think I'll skip that bit, just show what I think is... So the reason I sort of started working on Gaussian processes is I was at Aston when Chris Williams kept going on about them a lot. And I thought I should find out more about them. And I sampled from one once, and I just thought it was the coolest thing that you could sample functions. And I think I sort of fell in love with Gaussian processes when I first sampled functions from them. Well, so this is like when you fall in love all over again, when you sample from this covariance function. Because what you're actually doing is you're sampling jointly the driving force and three output functions. The coolest thing about this, which I don't have time to show the little demo I've got for that, is you can actually solve this, you can reverse this differential equation just with this covariance function. From observing y, you can condition on what you believe the input f was and deconvolve the thing just by conditioning in Gaussians, which is really nice. So here's a sample from the system. And what we've got is the black is the driving latent force. Red is the underdamped. Blue is the critically damped, and green is... Sorry, red is the... underdamped. Blue is the critically damped, and green is the overdamped. Now, what's interesting here is you get this sort of response of red when it gets hit at the right time, because the length scale of black is not matched quite to the natural frequency of the system. So you get these quite complex behaviors where the underdamped sometimes is oscillating or resonating. So here it gets hit bang, bang at the right times, and the response of the red is to resonate. But it doesn't always come up with larger amplitude than the black. If it gets hit at the wrong time, then it doesn't necessarily resonate. So this is much more so as a mechanical engineering student, you would sort of see, you would get shown the result of putting a sinusoid, forcing this system with a sinusoid. And it is actually really boring. I mean, it looked interesting a bit at the time. But you can get much, much more complex behaviors by forcing these systems with Gaussian processes. Very flexible behaviors, too. So here's another example where actually it never manages to get red going by banging it enough at the right time. And here's an example where it sort of hits it twice in the right time and then reds off into some sort of big oscillations. So there's some quite nice behaviors that we want out of that system. So what I want to do is, I'm just going to show the motion capture. I won't have time to show the systems biology example. Okay, so motion capture data, as I say, it's an interesting data set because it's high dimensional. And what we've got here is three different... So I'm going to show you some training data. So this is in the form of a time series, high-dimensional time series of angles at all these joints. That's the form of this data, and we're visualizing it as a human. So there's two subjects here. So we've got two input training data sets, and they're both doing similar motions, but they're slightly different. Now, the test motion is more different than the two input motions. And what we're going to do, well, what we did in this experimental setup is take... these two guys, and we actually assume that they're independent. Now, that's not the best thing to do, and we now do much better and more interesting things, correlate these things between themselves. We assume that they're independent, and we fit a shared set of parameters of masses, springs, and dampers at every joint. So we're basically modeling this guy as having forces at this joint here, which are acting on a system which is sprung and there's mass. Now, it's not the right model because, as you can work out, if you do that and then you do that, the resonant frequency of your arm changes because the effective mass perceived by this joint is changing. So it's not the right model, but it does have some of the right characteristics, such as resonance, and that turns out to be important. We purposefully chose the most different of these three motions where he does this similar thing to be the test data. Unfortunately, you probably won't see it so much, but he does a more exaggerated motion in this third motion. And then in terms of experiments, to show this extrapolation idea, there's much more involved experiments in the paper, but I kind of like this first experiment. And across, we also look at spatial systems in the paper. In terms of experiments, what we did is we said, well, I want to predict what the left arm does given only the inputs at the shoulder. So I've got three inputs at the shoulder. The reason we want to do it like that is because we can use a standard regression. We can say, have regression as the input and then predict the angles at the outputs, and using standard Gaussian process regression. But what we're going to do is we actually have the time series. So our model is predicting. Then you make three observations or three angles on that time series. And conditioned on those, you predict what the other outputs should be. And the idea is that you've got more understanding that it's a physical system, that it can resonate. So you should do slightly better. And indeed, we do slightly better. But the important bit is probably these plots here. What's actually going on is, so this is the standard regression, is trying to predict these angles. This is the hand rotation, thumb X rotation, thumb Z rotation, hand rotation, wrist rotation. So all these parts here. The Gaussian process, standard Gaussian process, is trying to predict them and does an okay job until it reaches a region where it's seen no data before. Because this data is substantially, the test data is substantially different from the training data. So when it gets in this region here, it doesn't do the right thing. It basically does what a Gaussian process will do, and it just goes to its prior predictive variance, mean plus one standard deviation. And in fact, it doesn't really know what's going on in here at all. Similar for here. And on these, though, the model which understands the physical nature of the system can capture these extra oscillations, because they're resulting from wobbling of the hand. Okay, and as a final thing, I'd just like to show a quick demo of, because this is, of how this sort of works in practice. So hopefully what you should see now is, so we talked a little bit about principal component analysis at the beginning. It's quite awkward for me to draw on this now. So what I want you to look at here is, unfortunately, screen slightly smaller up here than my screen, is that these are now, so this is like looking at the first two principal components of this data, but they're now latent forces. So there's a dynamic element to them. So if we were to just take PCA on this data, we could project it into two dimensions, and we might see a series of plots. Here I've shown the dynamic element by putting arrows in as well. So what you're seeing is those two training motions there and there. So generally, there's a force going downwards, and then there's a force oscillating left to right. But of course, now what we can do, because it's a generative model, if I can hold my hand steady, is I can now try and generate similar motions. Oh, and I forgot to stop it, so it's going to do something silly at the end. So that's something related, but actually he's going a lot further back than he does in the original data. So here, if I try and follow the original data a bit, in the original data, he goes back a little bit at the beginning, and actually I didn't stay down long enough to bring his knee up properly. But I can even sort of do things where I make him stay down here all the time, and then he'll bring his knee up to something he doesn't do in the training data. But I think you'll agree, it's not totally unnatural. I mean, there's characteristics of it that you would believe, yeah, that's reasonable. And that's because it understands some physics about what's going on in the system. The coolest thing I think you can do is actually something that he doesn't do at all in the training data, which is to bring him down, and then, if I stay up here long enough, he should go back up again. Or he should bring the leg back. Now, he doesn't do that in the training data. He also has a rather flexible knee joint, which, if I keep him up here long enough, we can give him some excruciating pain. Okay, well, that's mainly, main action I'm doing is in this axis here, and actually that's the main axis. The other component isn't that much used. But if I can just, as a final thing, zoom in on the hand and show you where it is being used, is if I just try, oh, sorry, I messed that up. Oh. And I moved him as well. So, having trouble with my interface. Let's try and move his hand back on screen. So try and watch the fingers at the end of the hand, because that's where actually there's these little oscillations going on. Now, you don't tend to see them so much as they... just at the end of the hand there, you see these little oscillations? Well, they're actually... oh, dear. Oops, I've got the... Okay, let's try that one more time then. Believe me, I hallucinate them all the time. So you see the little oscillations on the fingers there? That's all that's really doing. I think it's not really capturing anything. So it's basically got all the emotion in the other dimension. But it's not doing anything stupid. If you look at the overall picture of the guy, see if I can zoom out again. I didn't practice this, so this might not work. Ah, apparently I can't.
No, okay, forget it. So actually, he doesn't do anything strange when I put that input. So it's actually learned something quite nice about the model. So we've got lots of applications of this in systems biology, which I didn't have time to talk about. And we're also extending them for nonlinear systems using approximations and the strong relations to the sort of work Darren's talking about, although we've got some stochastic Gauss-Markov systems, but nothing as complex as he was using. That's it. But I don't want to, because I'm not doing a mechanistic model of human motion. I'm trying to demonstrate a mechanistic model that is general purpose. So actually, I want this to go wrong when it should go wrong. Now, of course, if we were going to do graphics and stuff like that, yes, that you should absolutely be doing that in the final application. But I'm not using this data set to show you... I want you to see the flaws in the model, basically, as well, things it won't pick up. Now, I think you're absolutely right, but I haven't done that in this case.
So it would be difficult to do, right, with a GP model?
There's two... so I've thought about it quite extensively for other reasons. I haven't put some of these ideas into practice, but there's a lot of constraints in here already because you've expressed the thing in terms of angles and limb lengths. Now, if you're going to put a constraint in terms of how that you can't go back beyond a certain point, yeah, it's not the easiest thing to do. There's another thing that GPs aren't very good for in this case, which is if the force is discontinuous. And that happens when you walk. So most impact forces, so if I bang into Charles... then, that type of motion is a response to an impulse. So we've actually got a paper on switching between different Gaussian processes and getting those responses in. So you go from one Gaussian process and then you switch it off, you force continuity across the displacements and velocities and switch on another Gaussian process, and that works really well. So if you fit it to walking data, it puts all the discontinuities every time the foot touches the ground. I think you're right, the constraint, discontinuities and constraints are two issues here.
And so I see what you're trying to do here. It's all very interesting. But how many applications are there where you're sure the ideas of inertia and sort of masses, springs, and whatnot are relevant, where you don't really want to just put in the little bit of extra time and put some physics in? You're identifying a set of stuff where inertia specifically is good, mass specifically is good, but you don't want to just put in a few more of Newton's laws.
I'm not saying that, I mean, we're talking about in terms of the framework, it's that's just one thing you can do. I suspect there's going to be a lot for inertia, but I can't think of one at the moment. So. but inertia exists. It's all around. It's clear for human motion. There are other examples we've looked at, which are spatiotemporal systems. And in those cases, we're looking at diffusion setups. So I'm not trying to sell that you should always be putting inertia in your models. What I'm trying to sell is the idea that you should be taking a little bit of a mechanistic assumption and integrating it in your model in such a way that it's not overruling your model, but it's augmenting your model in some sense.
Okay, so with any luck, there will be sandwiches waiting for a...